How you doing? Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've got a hell of a show for you today. I say that all the time, but this time I'm serious, and next week I'll be just as serious, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with playwright Roger Crane, who wrote the play The Last Confession. And I'm telling you, you want to stick around for that one. This is all about how murder, mayhem, mafia, and who knows what the hell is going on in the Vatican, or was going on in the Vatican, and probably still is going on in the Vatican, and the play is just a killer. Not joking at all about that. Anyway, before that, we'll be talking with two women from Harlem whose apartments were raided. June 4th police raid, the massive police raid that was the new example of new style policing from the de Blasio Bratton gang in New York, the mayor and the chief of police in New York. And they carried out a raid using 400 cops, and they arrested at least 50 people, and it was just outrageous. Young men carried away in chains, dragged out of their apartments, carried away in chains. We'll be talking with two women from those projects about those raids and what happened and their thoughts on it. Opening the show up, though, I'm very, very pleased to be bringing onto the show Brian Knappenberger, writer, producer, and director of a film that I saw up at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year. And the film is The Internet's Own Boy, The Story of Aaron Swartz. And rather than me go on and give you a whole pile of stuff, I'm going to play the trailer from the film, and then we'll come back and we'll talk with Brian about the film, why he made it, what he's thinking about, and who was Aaron Swartz. Teddy, play that track, man.
You know, it's easy sometimes to feel like you're powerless, like when you come out in the streets and you march and you yell and nobody hears you. But I'm here to tell you today, you are powerful. You can stop this bill.
A co-founder of the social news and entertainment website Reddit has been found dead.
Aaron learned how to learn at a very young age.
Bob introduced him to computers, and he just took off.
He certainly was a prodigy, although he never kind of thought of himself like that.
He really had different aspirations for the purposes of political goals.
He was sort of learning to hack politics.
Stop SOPA!
This bill poses a serious threat for all who use the internet.
The freedoms our country had been built on would be suddenly deleted. I couldn't let that happen.
Aaron was trying to make the world work. He was trying to fix it.
Bringing public access to the public domain.
He doesn't hack JSTOR in the traditional sense of hacking.
He wasn't stealing, he was making a point.
They arrested him, strip searched him, and left him in solitary confinement.
And he said, they want to make an example out of me.
On the internet, everybody has a license to speak. It's a question of who gets heard.
Aaron Swartz was not a criminal.
You can say, oh, this is another instance of cyber war. The cyber criminals are attacking us again. They use those as excuses to push through more and more dangerous laws.
This is a poor use of prosecutorial discretion.
Should have never gotten the attention of the criminal system.
We need to galvanize opposition today, because today is when it matters.
I'm still angry. This is what we as a people think is okay.
Aaron was willing to put himself at risk for the causes that he believed in.
He was the internet's own boy, and the old world killed him.
All right, welcome back. And that was the trailer from really an important new film. And it's actually going to be opening up all over the place, all over the country. And it's really important that people get out there and see this and start to talk about it. And here to talk with us about it is Brian Knappenberger, the writer, producer, and director of the film The Internet's Own Boy, The Story of Aaron Swartz. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Great trailer, by the way.
Thank you.
Sure. I had to play it because I thought rather than just sort of go through the whole thing and I wanted to give people a sense of the scope of the film, but also the scope of Aaron Swartz and your thinking on it. And let me ask you this to start off with. What was it in particular? We heard a whole bunch of things about Aaron and about how he was looking at things, but what was it in particular that compelled you to make this film?
Well, my previous film was called We Are Legion, The Story of the Hacktivists. And I was doing a number of panels and talking about that film. And one was about a week after Aaron died. I was on a panel at an event in New York City. And on the panel with me was Quinn Norton, who was an ex-girlfriend of Aaron's and is actually in the film. So I immediately started interviewing her and people around us. It seemed like everybody had a story of him. And this was at the very beginning of this big wave of anger and frustration and sympathy that was sort of, you know, bubbling up from the internet. And I just wanted to understand why this story resonated so much with so many people. And I personally just found the story very compelling and a way to, since he was so, is involved in so many things and so many interesting and relevant issues, I found that telling his story was a way to kind of jump off and talk about some of these bigger issues.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that really got me is that when you listen to him talk in your film and you look at some of the things, you do some research around him and what he was doing, this whole point that I think his brother made is that Aaron was always trying to make the world work. And yet early on, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, actually, I think maybe Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web, actually says that about him.
Oh, okay.
That he's got this kind of tenacity about if you feel like you've got skill, and he says this a lot in the film, and other people say it about him as well, that he had this sense that if you had real skills that could make a difference, then you really had to come up with a reason why you weren't using them to actually make a difference. If you felt like you could do good in the world and you weren't, then why not?
Mm-hmm. And early on, he actually had a lot of collisions around how the world actually did work and how it should work and what he wanted to do with it, what he thought was actually a moral imperative to do, right?
Yes. I mean, it's a complex, the actual actions that he took. He did so many different things in his life. And the actions also say something about how he felt about freedom of information, and particularly kind of either government-funded documents or taxpayer-funded research or things that on the outset should really seem like they should be a part of the public domain.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to play one more clip just so people can, it's only 30 seconds, just so people can get a sense of his own voice and him talking about this as well. Teddy, let's play track 3.
I feel very strongly that it's not enough to just live in the world as it is, to just kind of take what you're given and, you know, follow the things that adults told you to do and that, you know, your parents told you to do and that society tells you to do. I think you should always be questioning. Once I realized that there were real serious problems, fundamental problems that I could do something to address, I didn't see a way to forget that. I didn't see a way not to.
Yeah, didn't see a way not to. You can't forget that, and didn't see a way not to forget it. This is something that I thought was really important because it really does bring to a focus his whole, you know, his view of the world in a certain sense, which, yeah, on one hand was like he was against the you know, control of knowledge and things like that by private corporations, but it was also had more to do with that point he makes about. And I think they're related, so it's not more to do really, but it also had to do with the point he makes about really this is you can't rob humanity of all the collected experience and knowledge that's gone before us, you know, and it has to be available to people. And I thought that was really very heavy in his whole ethos.
Yeah, I mean, this is at the heart of what may have, you know, actually got him into trouble. He goes on the MIT network, and then from the MIT network, he has access to the JSTOR database. JSTOR is one of these companies that is a kind of repository of human knowledge and research, and it's a bizarre system that we have in which some of these, JSTOR is not the worst offender, but some of these companies, they take this research, they take the copyright of researchers, and then they sell it back to you. You know, it could cost you, if you're not involved with an institution or a university, it could cost you $50, $60, $70 a pop. And if you are involved in an institution, those universities have to buy subscriptions to these databases. So this was offensive to him. Clearly, he was part of a kind of open access movement that protested this. But I think that this notion that the world's knowledge is locked up in an ivory tower away from people that can use it, you know, to do interesting things, to cure diseases, to build on our collective knowledge, you know, this is one of the big promises of the Internet in the beginning anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a part of this movement. We don't know what he was going to do with those articles. He never did anything. He was actually arrested before he sort of uploaded them anywhere, dumped them anywhere. And so that's part of the mystery of the case.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Brian Knappenberger, the filmmaker, director of The Internet's Own Boy, The Story of Aaron Swartz. Now, Brian, one of the things I wanted to pursue a little bit is this. There's a point in here that what he did, no matter what his intentions were, what he actually did was not, in fact, criminal, right?
Certainly that's what they contended all the way up to the end. It's an interesting case when you sort of look at it. All of the charges against him were about access, essentially, whether he had violated access to this database, had unauthorized access. And at the outset, at least at first, it's pretty clear that he did have access to it. He had access to MIT, clear path from MIT to JSTOR. You don't need to be a student at MIT to have that access. So, but at the same time, they clearly didn't mean for him to download 4.7 million academic journal articles. So at some point, he crosses the line. And as Cory Doctorow says in the film, it's a little like checking too many books out of the library. Where is the crime? Where does the crime happen? How big should it be? Clearly, the government was pursuing him as though this was, stealing credit card numbers, or as this was a very, very serious crime. Their first press release said he could face up to 35 years in prison and a $1 million fine. He was offered plea deals that were much smaller than that, but involved less jail time, that kind of thing. But it really opens up a kind of can of worms. And for Aaron, sadly, it was a 2-year legal nightmare sorting through this.
Yeah, yeah. And, one thing I was thinking about in relation to the film and some of the quotes you have from him in the film, where he talks about the public access to public knowledge. And there's a point in here where he actually even takes this beyond the realm of those in this society or the intellectuals in this society, or whatever, anybody who has access to the internet. He actually expands it out and he looks at what happens in these places, even places overseas, whether you're in Africa, India, someplace like that, and you're a kid with a computer and you're trying to look at stuff and you can't have access to this knowledge. And he seemed to have a deep concern about bringing public access to the public domain, but also putting that in the context of the lopsidedness, the disparity that exists in the world, and looking for a way to kind of hit at that.
Absolutely, yeah, I totally agree. That did concern him, the access in developing countries to knowledge, and the idea that a lot of the knowledge and a lot of this research was created by taxpayers, and so it should be in the public domain. And this is how we progress as a species. We look at the great minds that came before us, and we look at what they've done, and we build on it. And this is these companies hold the knowledge of the greatest minds of our moment and the past. So, yeah, this did definitely offend him. One thing that happened right after Aaron died, as if we needed a kind of exclamation point on how important the kinds of things that he was fighting for were, Jack Andraca comes forward. Jack Andraca is a 14-year-old, gifted, curious kid, just like Aaron was, and he comes forward and has access to JSTOR, right? So he's got some kind of access to where he could look through the articles of JSTOR. And he's rooting around in JSTOR, and with his own kind of curiosity and experimentation, creates an early detection test for pancreatic cancer. This is something that's been deeply, deeply needed in that community. Pancreatic cancer, the 5-year survival rate is less than 5%. And so that community has needed that, some kind of early detection test, for a very long time. Basically, by the time you figure out you have pancreatic cancer, it's too late. So because of access, this young kid is able to come up with this stuff. This is how it should work, right? This is how we should come up with new things. This is harnessing the power of the internet at its best. So that happened, and then of course Jack Andraca said, this is why what Aaron was fighting for was so important, as if we needed a more clear example.
Mm-hmm. And he also had a very strong feelings about not just the ability to that everyone has the ability to speak on the internet and should have the ability to speak on it, but the question that remains also to be solved is who, in fact, then gets heard and where.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so that's actually, we play a clip like that of him in the early in the film. It's certainly something he was thinking about. It certainly was kind of central to his thinking early, like how do you sort through all this information? And I would say that's definitely in the, as in his early years, as he's thinking about RSS and Creative Commons and Reddit, even, I think that sort of question was informing all of that.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Brian Knappenberger, the filmmaker, director of The Internet's Own Boy, The Story of Aaron Swartz. Let's jump into this. They went after him with the vengeance. I mean, they really, really went after him. And the whole point of, even after JSTOR decided they weren't going to do anything about it, they just hammered away at him and made it clear. I mean, he was facing major charges, 13 felony counts, 35 years in jail. They weren't going to budge an inch. Why do you think, one, can you talk about what it was that he was facing? And then why do you think that they went after him so hard?
There's a couple of different answers to that, probably. One it could be just this, once this machine gets going in our system, it's almost impossible to stop. Prosecutors really have incentive to notch convictions, and their goal is to break a defendant, really. That's really what they're trying to do. They're trying to force a plea. That's one reason. There's more to it with Aaron, it seems to me. The prosecutors told Aaron's dad that they wanted to make an example out of him, that they needed a case for deterrence. And, you know, that immediately makes you wonder, well, deterring what? What kind of behavior were they trying to deter here? A lot of people downloading articles from JSTOR. I mean, is it hacking in this broad, general, kind of vague sense that they're trying to deter? Were they trying to, who knows? I mean, the vast majority of the activity that I saw him engaged in doing this documentary is political organizing. So, you know, it's just presumably the kind of thing we want to encourage. So, you know, that's the deeper kind of mystery, I think, that his case scratches the surface of.
Well, there's another element in there, too, because this is all occurring in the era of Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, Snowden, Edward Snowden, you know, these kinds of things. And the idea that a society that is built on all of these things, I mean, if you step back and you look at it, and it's a little bit like my coming guest is going to be talking about the Vatican and the question of the murder of Pope John Paul I, right? And there's, you know, and whether that actually was a murder or whatever. But he pulls back the cover and shows a lot of things going on that are really just mind-boggling and disgusting. And when you look at this, you know, Aaron made a comment once where he said that he thinks that the people who really believe wholeheartedly in secrecy, that those are the people, all the secrecy served was the people who were in power, and it didn't serve humanity. And that whole idea of having to control all of this, because this society needs that, I mean, I think this society needs that kind of control, because otherwise, if it doesn't have that, all hell could break loose and big things, good things as well as bad things could go on.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the argument. David, another commenter makes that point in the film, but not Aaron doesn't say that directly. But yeah, the point is that secrecy serves those in power, and that I think, you know, Zoe Lofgren actually also says in the film that governments have a desire to control, and that's their perspective, that's where they're coming from. So yeah, it becomes a battle over secrecy. I mean, I think though that at the heart of our system is understanding what our government is doing, what our relationship is with our government, our actual relationship, whether that comports with what we think our government should be doing in terms of basic constitutional protections. A big piece of the puzzle about our relationship with our government, we just didn't know until Edward Snowden came forward. We didn't know how they're interpreting those laws. We didn't know that they thought mass suspicionless dragnet surveillance was perfectly fine and not at all at odds with the Constitution of the United States, which the Fourth Amendment presumably protects us from searches by our government. We have protections from government overreach in our country. It's the Constitution, it's the court system. And the only way we can, those things can adequately function is if we have the truth, and there is a degree of transparency. The problem is we're in an era of just enormous transparency where the knee-jerk reaction is to classify and to hide activity. This is the era that we're in, and I think that that's a problem.
Right, and if you just look at this recent memo that the Obama administration was forced to release on their, you know, their targeted killings overseas of Americans, you know, there's things that get revealed.
That's a perfect example.
Yeah.
Look, if you're going to make the argument that that's okay, then you got to back up that argument. And this is something that's happening completely in secret. People have been pestering them for some once these kinds of stories come out that we are actually killing American citizens overseas if they've got involved in these groups without due process, without any sort of protection. At the very, very least, that's something we should be talking about and understanding what the criteria are, what it is that the government is thinking in that case. I mean, I think that's a pretty obvious example.
Mm-hmm. All right,
I mean,
Brian.
It's a disturbing and shocking example.
Yeah, yeah. And it actually, it really brings home one of Aaron's fundamental messages of you got to keep questioning. You can't just look and say, okay, I get it, whatever. You got to keep questioning and then act on what you find out. Brian Knappenberger, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sure, and thanks for the film, man. I want to let people know that it opens this week in Atlanta, Boston, Chicago, Cleveland, Denver, L.A., Miami, New York, Toronto, Washington, and Columbus, Ohio. And then it's going on to Canada July 4th in Phoenix, San Francisco, and San Jose, and July 11th in Seattle, and many other places. And you can see it on demand as well from Amazon, Google Play, iTunes, Vimeo, Vudu, and other providers. Don't miss this film, folks. This is really important to get up and be talking about. Brian, again, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with filmmaker-director Brian Knappenberger, the director of The Internet's Own Boy, The Story of Aaron Swartz. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with two of our guests from Harlem talking about the recent raids on the Harlem housing projects.
What we gonna do about the man in blue? What we gonna do? What we gonna do about the man in blue?
right. Yep, I'm jumping up and down, yelling that one out now. All right. Welcome back. I'm Michael Slate, and it's the Michael Slate Show. And our next guests are Catherine and Treva. I hope I'm pronouncing Treva's name right, but we'll find out in a second. And they are two women from Harlem, and they're here to talk with us about their firsthand experiences with and opinions around the recent NYPD raid on Harlem housing projects that happened on June 4th. And this was when more than 400 heavily armed cops broke down doors, terrorized people, and dragged dozens of young black men aged 15 to 30 out of their homes in chains, okay? So I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Catherine. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. And Treva, am I saying your name right?
Yes.
Okay, Treva, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, Catherine, let's start with you. Tell people what, you know, because we didn't hear that much about the particulars of what happened, what it was like. What happened the night of June 4th or the early morning of June 4th?
Well, it was approximately 5 minutes to 6 in the morning, and I heard a whole lot of noise inside my apartment, and I was figuring out there's nobody in my apartment but me and my grandson. So I jumped up out of bed, and I opened my room door to an assault rifle in my face. I was told, bitch, put your hands up. I was put handcuffs on, pulled into my living room with my face smashed against the wall. The whole time I'm asking, what is going on? My grandson is screaming in the back. And I'm saying, can I get my grandson? They told me we'll get to him later. I said, what are you here for? They told me I knew what they was there for. They never told me why. They tore my apartment apart the whole time, got me face my face to the wall. And I'm screaming, what are y'all here for? What's going on? Let my grandson come to me. 15 minutes later, they let my grandson come to me, who was screaming hysterically. They tore my entire apartment up. I said, well, at least you have a search warrant. What are you looking for? No search warrant was produced. After my house was torn up, one of the other cops said, well, showed me a picture of my son and said, well, he's the reason why we tore your house up. I said, what are you looking for him for? What did he do? Never once did I know what he did. Never once was I told why he hadn't been arrested, because he doesn't live with me, first of all. He doesn't live in my apartment. So a few minutes later, a cop came up and said, oh, by the way, we have your son, Isaac Waterman. And they left out of my house. So I still didn't know why they had my son. I didn't know what was going on until the June 5th when someone else told me. And when I got outside, I found out that they ran up into at least 60 different people's houses. Some people got whipped upon, like an old man got beat up because he couldn't tell them where his grandson was at. Children were getting guns pointed to their faces. The cops outside taking pictures of each other because they thought this was the biggest thing ever. I mean, my son does not belong to a gang. Of course, there's a lot of people. We live in a project. There's no places for these kids to go and play. They sit on corners and they play with each other. So now they're a gang. And then they go into their Facebook and say that this is why they arrested them, because of stuff in their Facebook. I thought we had the First and the Fourth Amendment, but I guess I was mistaken, that they can just run them into our house because we're black people and we live in a project and do whatever they want to do.
Yeah, exactly. And that's extremely important in terms of, especially when you talk about, you know, a lot of these things about these, the Constitution, constitutional protections and all this stuff. Really, you're dealing with a document and a whole system that's been built on the backs of black people, the enslavement of black people. And actually, for the longest time, they've never really repealed the Dred Scott decision that said, well, you know, black people don't have any rights that a white person is obliged to respect. And that's the way that this whole system has come down. And particularly looking, you know, the unleashing of absolute police terror on people like you went through. Treva, what was your experience in all this?
Yeah, well, it was my sister it happened to. I'm calling her phone like 5:30. We hear all the helicopters, and my daughter went outside to get ready to go to work, and there's like about maybe 40 police cars out there and a bunch of undercover gang unit people lined up outside. They came and bust her door down, bust it open, and came in and busted my niece's room. They threw her on the floor with no clothes on. She said, can I put clothes on? They told her, no, you're not putting no clothes on. They put handcuffs on her. Then they went to the next room where my nephew was. They tore the door, completely down. His couch in there, the bed upside down. They ripped the furniture. They went in the kitchen, poured all the cereal, the food out of the cabinets, on top of the cabinets, in the refrigerator. They tore the whole kitchen up. Then they handcuffed my sister, her baby father, and my niece was there crying. She peed on herself, and she said, can I get to my daughter? Like, what's going on? shut up. We don't want to hear it. They ask for her social security number. They taking pictures. They high-fiving each other, saying, yes, 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 we did it. So my sister want to know, like, what's going on? Why y'all busting my door? Why? And they told her to be quiet. She don't need to know. So they took my nephew down and threw him in the back of the police car, and we didn't get no search warrant or anything. They just told everybody to be quiet. They went to her neighbors next door. They knocked on her door, told her son we're taking him out, or because he got an incident in the Bronx. Nobody knows what's going on. They just raided into people's apartments, and it don't make no sense. They could give somebody a heart attack or whatever. It's the wrong reason how they going about it. Like I said, I'm not saying these kids nowadays are innocent, these kids that they picked up. I'm not saying they're innocent, but there's a better way they have to approach people's apartments. Like, they literally tore the door down, tore the apartment up with no explanation about anything. As far as we know, somebody could be coming and kidnapping. Like, we're not in the project. We live in an apartment building. These kids over here are not considered a gang. These kids were raised and went to school since they were little. Some of these kids are in college. Some kids are working. And no, the parents doesn't know anything. They just bust in the door, broke the front door down to the point that she had to get a new door. The bedroom door is all in pieces. The closets are messed up. The beds, they just tore everything up. They put guns to everybody's head, 3-year-old heads, 14. And they told my niece she could not put no clothes on. And I don't think that is not appropriate for police to come in there and not let her put on her clothes. No one knows what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's sad because we should not have to live like that because we're black. These kids are not only on the street just doing this and that. These kids that they picked up, a lot of them are working in college and school and everything. You know, just because they see a couple of guys, oh, they're considered a gang. These kids over here on Manhattan Avenue are not in a gang. There are friends that went to PS180 together. They went to school together. That's it. And I don't understand why they, just because kids are black, oh, they're considered a gang. These kids are not a gang. Money Ave is not what you call a gang. Money Ave is where the block, this is the name of the block. There's a big sign up there to say Money Ave. I mean, they completely tore everybody apart. My niece peeing on herself. They didn't even let her mother take care of her or anything. It's ridiculous how we have to live. You're scared to send your kids outside because you don't know what's going to happen. If you can't go to the police and get help from them, who can you help? You can't help nothing if you can't go to the police. They high-fiving each other, so happy what they did. And, I mean, you have the parents worry because they just snatched the child out the house and threw him in the trunk like they a piece of garbage.
Mm-hmm.
It's not right.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's criminal, and it's just outrageous. And it actually reminds me very much, as I said last week when we were talking with Carl Dix about this, it reminds me of the German raids on the Jewish ghettos under Nazi Germany. You know, this is the kind of thing where black people are not even considered to have human rights because they're not considered human under this system. Let me ask you, let me remind people, you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking with Catherine and Treva, two women from Harlem who are telling us about their experiences with the June 4th police raids, the massive police raids on Harlem housing projects and apartment buildings by 400 heavily armed cops, breaking down doors, terrorizing people, dragging dozens of young men at 15 to 30 out of their homes in chains, okay? That gives you a sense of what this is all about, in chains. Now, Catherine, you also had an experience when Treva was talking about the young people and all. You had an experience with your grandson, which was actually shows how outrageous this thing and what's going on. Tell people about what happened with your grandson.
Well, my grandson, I guess he was outside playing, and they must have been taking pictures of him, and they put in the Daily News that a picture of about 7 or 8 young kids, maybe 8 to 11. These are the new gang wannabes. They're out there. All they aspire to do or to be is a gang member. My grandson is 8. He has even an alternate plan because he wants to be a basketball player, but he said, Grandma, if that doesn't work out, I want to be a lawyer so I can help all of these boys out because the cops keep grabbing them up. So for him to be 8 and have a plan like that, that's not what he want to be, is a gang member. We send our children out to play in the park. We can't send them to a community center because we don't have any. I don't understand why you come to the project. You can go to another neighborhood that's not the project, and these kids can sit out in front of their house, 10 or 20 of them, and they're fine because they're sitting in front of their house and their complexion is not black. So they can do that. They're not a gang. They're just a bunch of kids, friends playing. Why is it that when they come to the project, and I work for a living, and 99% of the people in the project work for a living, 99% of these kids go to school, like the other woman said. There are a few kids that don't do what they're supposed to do, but the roundabout, most kids do. And if they're criminals, I know I'm not. So why would you come in my house, put a gun to my head, and call me all kinds of names, push me around, and tear my house up? I'm not a criminal, but you did that to me too.
Well, let me ask you, Catherine, and then we'll ask Treva the same question. What's the response been in the neighborhood? Has there been people standing up against this? What are they doing? Have you heard about what's happening in the prisons as well?
Well, we've been doing a lot of walks, but right now my whole point is I'm very afraid because my son just been transferred to Rackers Island. And in Rackers Island, the kids are going crazy because it's a big thing with the guards. Just got into a whole lot of trouble. They raided the guards. And now the guards are just making them fight each other, putting them together, and not doing anything about it. So there's kids that's been stabbed up in there, and I'm very afraid for my child's life. And we've been marching, and the revolution has been wonderful to us because they've been helping us. People, the neighborhood has been coming out, and we're getting this around so more and more people are finding out what happened because a lot of people don't know what happened, and they can't believe that it happened. We need to get to our mayor who said this is just the beginning. He wants a whole lot more, our mayor.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Treva, what about you? What have you heard about the impact, what's going on in prison, and what about the impact on your neighborhood?
Yes, well, I had on my neighbor. The first or second day he was on a boat, he went to Rikers. They jumped him. They said they had two guys from Grant or whatever meet him in a staircase, and they beat him up. His mother had went the next day to find out what had happened. And then I heard when they was on the boat, some of the kids had said, the officer on the boat said, okay, we have Manhattan and Grant. Now y'all take over. Now y'all do what y'all got to do.
And Manhattan and Grant are the names of project buildings, right?
Yes, those are the projects that get into it, like Grant been getting into it with a lot of different projects. So they said they had Grant in Manhattanville on a boat and said, now here y'all are together, now fight. Yeah, so my neighbor, her son, they beat him up. She went to the jail, and he seen all these scratches and scars and bruises all over his body and said that they had him jumped in there. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous.
You know, here in California, one of the things they used to do is they used to get prisoners and they'd take them out into the yard and they'd have them do what they called gladiator battles. And the guards would bet on them. And then they would actually end up killing some of the people that either that were losing or that, you know, whatever. They actually ended up killing some of the people that were fighting. But they actually called on people to fight to the death a lot of times. And that's the kind of treatment that this is, again, because they don't see Black and Latino people is anything more than animals. And that's.
And another thing, like they've been investigating this for 4 years. I don't understand how they've been investigating this for 4 years. They let two people get killed. If they know two people 2 years ago got killed, why they let it go another two more years? So they just letting these kids really out here to kill each other and hurt each other, then trying to evict people out their projects. It's crazy because if y'all knew this has been going on for 4 years, y'all know about all these killings and stabbings and everything, and y'all waited 4 years later to do something about it. Like, why they didn't handle this 2 years ago when two people got killed? Mm-hmm. Then they trying to give these kids 15 to life. I don't understand. Whoever did these killings 2 years ago is in jail. They have these kids. Why are they charging all these kids? They just throwing all these kids in jail and giving them 15 to life. For what? Everybody, these 100 and people that they claim that did this and that, they didn't kill these two people. They gave these two people 25 to life. They got these people. Why are they giving these rest of these kids 15 to life? I don't understand. It's ridiculous how this justice system is going. It don't make no sense. Like, these Black kids is out here, they are trying to get themselves together. And how are they going to get themselves together? They get locked up and have a record. They ain't not going to be able to come home and get no job because they have this record. Yeah. It's ridiculous how Black people and Hispanic people have to live. It doesn't make any sense.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that's their point. Their point is to lock up all the kids now. So in 20 years, there won't be another generation of Hispanics and Blacks because all the boys are going to be in jail. Nobody's going to be able to have kids. That's their whole plan. It has nothing to do with it because if you felt that I was unsafe living where I live at for 4 years, you let these kids roam around and do what they did, and you didn't protect me, I'm a taxpayer. Right. You should have grabbed these kids up and when they did it and protected me. So you let me stay out here. So those two people that got killed, I blame that on the police, the commissioner, and the mayor because you allowed these people to stay out from 2010. These people got killed in 2011 and 2012. If you grabbed them up in 2010, maybe 2011 or 2012 murder wouldn't have happened.
All right, folks, we got to wrap this up, but I want to thank you both very much for joining us today. And we'll stay in touch to find out, to follow this as it goes along, the fight against it and all
thank
that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate
so
much. It. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks, folks. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Catherine and Treva, two women from Harlem and from the neighborhoods that were recently raided on June 4th, as a matter of fact, by 400 NYPD, and they rounded up dozens and dozens of young black men between the ages of 15 and 30 and took them out of their buildings, out of their homes in chains, and threw them into Rikers Island, where you've heard the horrific stuff that's going on there, and the judge has described these people as it was right to take them in because these are young men with murder in their hearts. All right? That's what he described as. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Roger Crane about his new play, The Last Confession. Stay tuned.
I like to think I've earned my reputation for rushing in where angels fear to tread. I'll take you home to meet the congregation. We'll all get together in my tent. I make a dirty little religion at 11. I'll make a dirty little convert out of you. I make a dirty little religion at 11. I'll make a dirty little convert out of you. They treat you like a red-headed stepchild and try to keep you nailed to the floor. Join us for the countdown to the rapture. We never turned a sinner from our door.
All right, I'll tell you. Dirty little religion. And I have to tell you, Roger, I was inspired off your play to play that song. It's Warren Zevon with Dirty Little Religion. All right, and I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next guest. His name is Roger Crane. He's a playwright, and he wrote the play called The Last Confession. And I have to tell you, I was riveted to my seat. And my friend who went with me, we came home, and we just couldn't stop talking about it. Now, I have one big question just to start this off, Roger. Welcome to the show first.
Thank you. Thank you sure. very much.
And I have one big question. What the hell were you thinking, man?
I was out of my mind. Anybody who sits on their back porch and has never written a play since college and decides to write a play about the Vatican with 18 speaking roles, mainly male, can't have a clue.
Well, the other thing is, now look, you're talking to somebody who, I mean, I had an aunt that was a nun, a great aunt that was a nun. My father used to say, boy, you're going to be a priest because it's the only way the Irish can get anything accomplished here. But I was also just traumatized by 16 years of Catholic school, okay? And when I saw this and I thought, okay, you're talking about murder in the Vatican. You're talking about cardinals and bishops who have more in common with Luca Brasi than anybody else, right? And you have all this stuff going on. Give people, as we're talking, I'm thinking you should give people a brief description of what the play is about.
Well, it's about the 33-day Pope, John Paul I, who in 1978 became Pope. He was a very gentle, holy man. At the time he became Pope, it was discovered later there was a $1.2 billion embezzlement going on through the bank, which was discovered after his death. The Vatican II would try to open the church up and remove a lot of the strictures. And the reactionaries in the church were fighting to cause that, roll all that back 100 years. And when he died after 33 days, there were many, many rumors and suggestions that he had been murdered. The church has admitted it lied about a number of very important facts. All the facts in the play are indisputable. There's nothing that can be disputed about what went on. But what it's really about isn't just about whether he was murdered or not. And the play doesn't, you probably will leave thinking a certain direction, but it doesn't make it conclusive because I can't. It's really about the struggle that went on for 33 days for the soul of the Catholic Church in 1978, a struggle that I think the reactionaries won, and a struggle that Pope Francis is now engaged in right now today, and hopefully succeeds.
One of the things that struck me, which you, again—
By the way, it's a very funny play.
What? Oh, I laugh a minute. I'm telling you. Boy, I mean, there were times where you got the lift. And it's interesting because the characters, I mean, it was, you know, on one level, you know, you look at this thing. I know people have said this to you. It's like, well, it was a thriller. It was a political thriller. And on one level, it is. But there's actually something much bigger going on, I think, and what we're talking about. I think, but even taking it out of the realm of the religious trappings or what, there's a morality play in there that's very, very heavy when you think about this. You know, what is it that actually is going to go on in the world? What is going to dominate in the world? What is the role of people who want to do good in the world? What's it going to be? And you have, and I know I'll massacre his name because I don't, David Suchet?
Suchet,
okay.
Yes, wonderful
okay.
actor.
All right, my assistant producer was right. He kept telling me, no, it's say it like the French, Suchet.
Suchet.
Okay. And yeah, he was tremendous. But he was somebody who really concentrated, in my mind, he really did concentrate it's kind of both sides of things in a certain sense. In the beginning, he had a high moral platform, but he also had a lot of other things going on, including the crisis of faith.
Well, I fell in love with John Paul I and his saintliness, and of course, there's an issue in the play of what happened if Christ came back and even let him in the Vatican. It creates some problems for him. So what happens if a saint tries to run the church? But you can't simply have a story. A good guy comes to town and good guy drops dead. So the storyline is, as much as I love John Paul I, is Benelli, played by Cardinal David Suchet. And in the play, he's lost his faith. So you have a cardinal comes within a few votes of becoming pope at one point, who has lost his belief in God and is still hungry for power but knows his failings. And the play is in large part about Benelli's journey, which is brilliantly played by David.
Yes, it's incredible. And actually, he played a role in helping you to finalize the play as well, right?
We talked about some things, but it was more technical for along the lines of, well, you don't know who this guy is, Crane, because you never use his name for a minor detail, David. Sorry about that. And then he did ask me to give him a few more lines in the last scene, which he helped him initially. And then I remember reviving it now. And he says, Roger, why do we have these extra three lines? I said, David, you asked me to write them. He said, I don't need them anymore. Okay, David, then we'll get rid of them. But he's absolutely brilliant in the role.
Yeah, and it's interesting because he himself is, when he's playing someone who's lost his faith, and he's actually also playing someone who is playing a big role in this major religion, and that role has to do with determining how this religion, which actually, if you think about it, has a long history of doing horrendous things, the actions of the popes towards the Jews all over the world, and the things that came up about John Paul II, mm-hmm. and all of these things, the whole question there, and yet you're dealing with David, who also is a man of strong faith himself, right?
Absolutely, but he himself says he's playing it even more brilliantly than he did in London, where he won a Variety Award for Best Actor in it. And he's brought a depth to it in terms of the loss of faith that's quite unbelievable. But some of the things that one line in the play is churches are not run by saints. They're run by men who understand power. And you think about it, saints are out being Mother Teresa. And so that's a quandary in the play. And there's a line which kind of gets thrown away because of what people are doing in the last scene, where David says to the confessor, who I won't identify, I will prove to the church that it is great enough to be wrong.
Well, it's interesting. it's really interesting because you also have this counterpoint because David's character, Cardinal Benelli, his thing where he actually, yes, he starts off from this place, but you also know that in there he's got that drive, that ambition. He's looking for power on one level. But you contrast him to Pope John Paul I, who actually, and the character, what's his name, the actor?
Richard O'Callaghan,
yeah. Yeah, he was remarkable in this as well.
He's brilliant in the role, playing a saint-like figure and making him human.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to make a saint-like figure human, and Richard does it superbly.
Right, and it was also, as you're watching him, you're thinking about, he's a guy who just got thrown into a shark tank, because you actually have mafia guys up in there, and you have these cardinals who are just like, actually even more dangerous than the mafia guys, because they're running the mafia guys. It's like, it's really, really intense, and yet that sort of juxtaposition is one that I think really runs through the play and gives it a backbone that's really important to grab hold of there.
And there's also a lot of humor in the way, that natural humor in the way Richard plays the Pope. I mean, we show him as a real human being. There are multi-levels in the play. I hopefully can be enjoyed simply as an entertainment and a thriller, but maybe even more hopefully people will go home and have something to debate about, argue about.
Well, I know my friend and I did.
Okay.
And we weren't arguing. We were just trying to figure, whoa, what is going on here? And I'm going to talk about this in a minute, but I want to let people know you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Roger Crane, the playwright of The Last Confession. Now, Roger, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is this. You have, when we're talking about the John Paul I.
By the way, I was educated for 16 years by Catholic school, from the Irish Christian Brothers to the Jesuits. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I got the best education that the 12th century had to offer, okay? I went to Villanova, all right? And I was educated by Augustinian monks, okay? So it was like, yeah, there was a problem there. But one of the things that brings up is I kept looking at this. There's an ideological line in this play that is an ideological level of the play that's extremely important, I think, because, you know, you have John Paul I. You have that character who's really he may look like he's weak or he's whatever. He's not capable of going up against the cardinals. But actually, he's so committed to what he believes that he does it. And it may have cost him his life.
It may have.
And then you have Benelli, who I think ideologically there's a whole other thing going on with him, because there's an element of where he's warned by one of the characters, I think, where he says, be careful of seeking power because your punishment may be finding it. And in a certain sense, there's a reality there that's very, very heavy in the play and in the world itself.
Well, he's a man who vastly desirous of power, knows he's vastly desirous of power. But in fact, and they keep trying to push him to become pope, but he's a man who's lost his faith. You have a quandary of a man who still may believe in the church but no longer believes in God being asked to push to become pope. And in fact, there's a line in the play when he declines the first time. And then he goes to the papacy and comes within 5 votes, historically accurate, of the papacy. And instead of John Paul II, it would have been him. John Paul II was a compromise. But there's a line in the play, perhaps they don't care to stand that close to God. By Cardinal Benelli.
Now, people have to put this all in perspective, because here's the end of the opening lines of the play where you have Benelli making one comment. What is it?
Please bless me, Father, for I have sinned because I have killed the emissary of God.
Okay, now this is the guy who's got the high moral platform, okay? This is a tough one. I have killed the emissary of God.
That's a good way to start off a play.
And I'm an atheist. You know? It's like, okay. But, you know, there is a point here where, you know, one of the things I watched in this is even you could give him, because he really cared about Luciana.
Yes, he did.
You know, he really cared about him. And that's John Paul I. And he cared about what was happening, what he saw was happening. He cared about trying to root out the corruption and the criminal activities and the long-standing rulers of the church and going against thousands of years of tradition in order to do that. And the problem was that he really didn't go against, you know, he would have had to go against that tradition. But I thought one of the problems was that he really ended up trying to fight it out using the same framework that the bad guys were using.
Well, there's a line when they're fighting over the second election when he comes within, you need 3/4 majority to be pope. He comes within 5 votes, and finally the compromise candidate he becomes pope is John Paul II, where one of the cardinals turns to him because he's fighting just as hard and dirty as the other side. And the line is, you know, in my country, he's from Africa, they have a saying, when you feed like the jackal, you become the jackal. How are we different from them? And another cardinal responds, ironically, because we're right, of course, which, of course, is always the excuse for anybody stooping to perhaps unscrupulous means to accomplish good.
Yeah.
Because, so there is a juxtaposition there.
Yeah, yeah, because we're right, of course, which is what they've used to justify so many things. I mean, that's the whole problem here. But it's interesting because this is your first play.
Well, I wrote from in college, but my first play since I was 22.
Right. Okay. You and I are about the same age, you know. Yeah.
We won't go there.
right. But this was a hell of a subject to tackle. And I'm curious as to what made you want to tackle this.
I, 30 years after I got out of college, ran into very briefly a retired director at a wine tasting and mentioned I'd written plays in college. He said, write a play, a murder mystery, they sell. I thought about this Pope who died under suspicious circumstances, so I was going to write a fictional murder mystery. Then I read all the books on the subject, and I said, they may have killed him, but I'm going to write about more than a murder mystery. I'm going to write about the church, and I'm going to write The Search for God, and I'm going to write about the corruption influences of power. And so I sat down on my back porch knowing nobody in the theater, wrote a play about the Vatican with 18 speaking roles, completely unproducible, a play that should interest nobody. And here I'm sitting here talking to you, and the play's running at the Amazon. It was, of course, the play in London at the Royal Haymarket 7 years ago. So as I like to tell people, if Hollywood did a movie about this, everybody would laugh at it. No one would take it seriously because it's impossible.
Actually, you know what's really interesting? is that it's not impossible. See, this is what's really interesting. And it's interesting, too, because, you know, one of the things like that really impacted me as well was the set for this, because I know a lot of people talked about, you know, and it's all that iron grating, and it just brings you, it puts you in this thing of where both you're taken back to medieval eras, and you're taken back to all the darkness, the Medici's, whatever, you know, all this, Don't go to church because they're going to cut your throat.
Well, the set designer, Bill Dudley, he's won more Olivier Awards than anybody in history. A genius.
An Olivier Award?
Is their equivalent of a Tony over there in England. Said I gave him the best brief of anybody and the shortest on how to do a set. And what I simply told him is, I said I wanted it to look like the Vatican and feel like a prison.
That's where I was going to go. It really did. I mean, and including every time you moved the bars, it was exactly, it had you prison. And within that prison, and that's the point about breaking out of this, for the need to break out of that framework, that prison had to be demolished in order to actually accomplish what the moral characters in the film were trying to accomplish, I think, or in that play, were trying to accomplish. And without doing that, that prison just got tighter and tighter and more solid.
It entangled them. And there's a wonderful line from one reviewer in London, which I wish was about my writing, but it was actually about the set, combines grandeur with a sense of doom.
Ah, there you go. And on that note, we're going to have to say thank you, goodbye, and thank you very much. And Roger, it was really a pleasure talking with you, and it was a pleasure seeing the play, and this is going all over the world. And if you, Roger, thank you very much for joining us today. Okay, take care now.
Thank you.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And we've just been talking with playwright Roger Crane about his new play, actually his first play in a long time, a play called The Last Confession. And it's all about murder and mayhem in the Vatican, and specifically about the very short career of Pope John Paul I, the pope that came in and tried to change the church and the way it went through the world. And mysteriously, he died after only 33 days as pope, all right? And then everything went back to creepily normal. Okay, so that's the story of that. But one of the things, one of the questions that came up in the course of thinking about this play for me was the idea that somehow going after power was a bad thing. Now look, this was a play, as I said, that I went home and I thought and I talked with my friend about it, and we just puzzled over it and kicked it around and, you know, really thought about it for a while. And one of the things that really came to mind for me was not so much the idea that actually seeking power can destroy you or seeking power is a bad thing, but more the idea that if you're really out there trying to fundamentally change things, whether it's the way things run in the church in the Vatican or, more importantly, the way the world runs, okay? If you're really out there trying to change things like that fundamentally and in a direction that would lead to the emancipation of all humanity, you need to get power to do that, all right? You need to actually really completely get rid of the old system and all that it does in the world and all that enforces all that terror and horror in the world, all right? So it's not a bad thing to go for power, but while you're doing that, you have to be very careful that you don't, as one of the characters in the play says to the cardinal who's really trying to be the Pope maker or really trying to maneuver behind the scenes to try and change things in his own way, that actually, if you eat like the jackal, you have to be very careful that you don't become the jackal. And what I think the lesson there is that you cannot change things fundamentally as long as you remain within the framework that those things are prospering in, that those things are part of, that actually reinforce and reproduce all of the screwed up things that come out of whatever it is that you're trying to change. And especially when we're talking about the system of capitalism and imperialism. But one of the things you do have to be careful of is you always have to operate with what your overall ethos. Don't let them take that away from you. Now, along those lines, I want to read something from Bob Avakian, and it's from his book, For a Harvest of Dragons. And it speaks exactly to this question. In the final analysis, as Engels once expressed it, the proletariat must win its emancipation on the battlefield. But there is not only the question of winning in this sense, but of how we win in the largest sense. One of the significant, if perhaps subtle and often little noticed ways in which the enemy, even in defeat, seeks to exact revenge on the revolution, and so the seed of its future undoing, is in what he would force the revolutionaries to become in order to defeat him. It will come to this. We will have to face him in the trenches and defeat him amidst terrible destruction. But we must not, in the process, annihilate the fundamental difference between the enemy and ourselves. Here, the example of Marx is illuminating. He repeatedly fought at close quarters with the ideologists and the apologists of the bourgeoisie, but he never fought them on their terms or with their outlook. With Marx, his method is as exhilarating as his goal is inspiring. We must be able to maintain our firmness of principles, but at the same time, our flexibility, our materialism and our dialectics, our realism and our romanticism, our solemn sense of purpose and our sense of humor. That's from Bob Avakian and his book, For a Harvest of Dragons. All right, so think about that until next week. Meanwhile, I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. And I also want to thank all of my guests, Brian Knappenberger, the director of The Internet's Own Boy, The Story of Aaron Swartz, Catherine and Treva, the two women from the Harlem Housing Projects who gave us their eyewitness accounts of what happened in the massive police raid on the Harlem Housing Projects on June 4th. And if you want to find out more about that, you should go to revcom.us, revcom.us. You'll find out all the articles, all the things that are going on there, and a lot more, a hell of a lot more, so you should really check that out. And again, I also want to thank Roger Crane, the playwright of The Last Confession. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And we're going to go out with something that I feel is really appropriate for everything we've been talking about today. All right, it's a little piece from Taj Mahal, and it's called, Oh Lord, Things Are Getting Crazy Up in Here. Check this out. Talk to you again next week. Situation.